In this episode of Political Ideologies, I'll be taking a look at the historical context of the French Revolution in 1789, an event that shocked Europe and had a huge impact on political philosophy. For most of its history, Europe has been ruled by aristocratic kings of various royal houses that were often interlinked through marriage. Our current Queen Elizabeth II is related to the former kings of Germany, Greece, Sweden, Denmark, Spain, and Norway, for instance. In the 18th century, as the Industrial Revolution began in Britain and started to spread through Europe, France's royal family was known as the House of Bourbon. Since 1643, when Louis XIV came to the throne, France had followed the concept of the divine right of kings, an absolute monarchy, where anything the monarch decided was acted upon. In England, this had led to the English Civil War and the execution of Charles I, establishing a parliamentary democracy with a constitutional monarchy, but in Europe, this change was yet to occur. Louis XIV was the most powerful king in French history, ruling from the age of four for 72 years. He lived in grand chateaus or castles and palaces such as the Louvre, which is now a big museum in Paris, and all the courtiers had to follow him wherever he went in order to get his decisions on how to run the country. Louis was often known as the Sun King for the amount of gold that decorated all his clothes and palaces. He was answerable to no one but God and therefore had no restraints. In 1678, Louis decided to build the grandest palace in all of France at a place called Versailles. With enough room to house the whole court, the palace and its surrounding buildings rapidly became symbols of an age when the nobility were prepared to go to any lengths to be close to the king. Under the sovereign's watchful eye, the nobility could no longer plot against the throne. The great lords were kept in their place in the army or at court, eager to serve and sycophantically please the king. Intimidating, majestic, and kept informed by an army of spies, the king controlled everything. The Palace of Versailles embodied the idea of the glory of France and the splendour of its culture and art and the complete control of the king. Upon his death, Louis XIV's grandson, Louis XVI, became king. Although Louis XIV was an absolute monarch with a disproportionate amount of wealth and power, he made decisions and had won several wars. In contrast, his grandson and his wife, Marie Antoinette, were indecisive and conservative rulers opposed to change. This led the people of France to view the monarchy as a symbol of the perceived tyranny of the Ancien Régime and their popularity deteriorated. It's important to understand the types of hierarchies that were in existence during France in this period. They were known as estates, and there were three different social classes in these estates. So the first estate was the clergy or priests, the second estate was the nobles, and the third estate was the commoners. And almost everybody in France, let's say 98% of the population, belonged to the third estate. And above all of these estates was the king. There was little chance for people to move from one estate to another, meaning that social mobility was not really a thing. It's also important to understand that there were three estates, so that the third estate, in which the majority of people were, would always be outnumbered by the other two estates, which would usually support the king and his decisions because they were nobles and the church, which benefited from the patronage of the king. So the third estate essentially had no political power and were excluded from most decision making by never being able to override the decisions of the other two estates. Now, 1789 becomes a critical year for France. The French government was in a major financial crisis. The king had borrowed far too much money in order to maintain his lavish lifestyle at the Palace of Versailles. And they've also borrowed a lot of money to fight against Britain in the Seven Years' War and the American War of Independence, because France and Britain had always been competing each other for their expanding empires and the influence that they could have in other countries. With such great debt accumulating, the king had no other option than to try and raise taxes. And the problem was that the commoners of France in the third estate were the people that had to pay the taxes, because the nobles and the clergy in the first and second estates were exempt from paying taxes. So the common people were getting more and more angry that higher taxes were being introduced in order for the king and his nobles to enjoy a lavish lifestyle that they were not even contributing towards. In this year as well, there was a terrible famine that hit France. And because most common people in the Third Estate ate bread to survive, which relies on corn or wheat, the cost of bread skyrocketed, meaning that people became even more hungry and starving, and the rich still did nothing to help, and the poor were still expected to pay higher and higher taxes. And this is where that famous phrase comes from, that Marie Antoinette says when told about the famine, that if they can't eat bread, let them eat cake. A kind of complete lack of understanding of the actual lives of poor people at the time. And there's also a long-term trend that helps contribute to the French Revolution, and that's the emergence of this kind of period of culture in Europe known as the Enlightenment at the time. So, you know, the word Enlightenment suggests kind of, you know, almost like a light bulb, ideas being kind of explored and developed. And this encourages people to think about the definitions for some kind of key words like liberty, democracy, etc. Because for hundreds of years, the people of France had simply blindly followed the king and accepted their place in life and in the hierarchy of the three estates. But the Enlightenment started to try and challenge, accepted norms. And the idea of the American Revolution, which started in 1776, gave the people of France kind of almost a role model to look up to about how you can kind of throw off the chains of oppression from a, ruling elite. That's one of the key points about the American Revolution and the Declaration of Independence, is that it's a type of government which is a republic. Their people are not ruled by a king at all. So discontent is growing among the members of the French middle and lower classes, and that is cementing opposition to the French aristocracy, and particularly to the idea of absolute monarchy. And Louis XVI and Marie Antoinette are seen as the, you know, kind of representatives of everything that is wrong in society. Now, it's quite telling of how much of an absolute monarchy France was at this time. When Louis XVI decides to call a meeting of Parliament, known as the Estates Generales, in May 1789. It's actually the first time that Parliament has met for almost 150 years. The last one was in 1614. And the only reason in which he calls this Parliament meeting in the first place is because the French government was having these financial problems. They didn't know how to solve them. And the problem soon emerges between the voting of the First and Second Estate always outvoting the much bigger Third Estate. And essentially, the Third Estate, you know, gets more and more angry with the situation. They're arguing about how these votes are really unfair, and they decide that actually, you know what, we're going to create our own parliament. And on June 13th, 1789, the Third Estate declares itself the National Assembly. And they say that, well, yeah, we're the parliament, we're going to begin making our own laws, and we're going to run the country. And essentially, that's the beginning of the revolution. And they run the country under the slogan of liberté, égalité, and fraternité, which means freedom, equality, and brotherhood. So these kind of, you know, central tenets of Enlightenment philosophy, particularly the idea of liberty and freedom, are completely embedded in everything about the French Revolution. You know, what does freedom mean? People should not have to be ruled by an autocratic ruler that makes decisions on their behalf. The people should be making the decisions. Now, the problem is that Louis XVI, of course, refuses to acknowledge that the new National Assembly is a thing. And so riots begin to erupt all over Paris. And on July the 14th, 1,000 protesters try to break into the Bastille fortress in Paris that was a state prison and contained weapons and gunpowder and was kind of like a symbol of the authority of the state, let's say. And they succeed in breaking into, or storming, the Bastille, as it's known, which is still celebrated every year as kind of, you know, the birth of the French Republic. Interestingly, there weren't actually that many prisoners in the prison itself, but the kind of symbol of it is like the success of the revolutionaries and the kind of commoners rising up against the authorities, and that encourages other people around France to rise up against the authorities and nobles who had ruled them for so long. One of the first things that the National Assembly decides to do on the 26th of August 1789 is to make a declaration of the rights of man and citizens. And these hold some really, really important ideas that, you know, political philosophers have debated for centuries. So number one is that men are born and remain free and equal in their rights. Number two is the aim of all political association is the preservation of the natural and imprescriptible rights of man, which are liberty, property, security, and resistance to oppression. Number three, that the principle of all sovereignty resides essentially in the nation. Nobody nor any individual may exercise any authority which does not proceed directly from the nation or from the citizens without the consent of the citizens, let's say. Number four, that liberty consists in the freedom to do everything which injures no one else. Hence, the exercise of the natural rights of each man has no limits except those which assure to the other members of the society the enjoyment of the same rights. This is the idea of the harm principle, which is really important in liberal political philosophy. And number five, law can only prohibit such actions as are hurtful to society. Nothing may be prevented which is not forbidden by law, and no one may be forced to do anything not provided for by law. So it's quite a radical overhaul of the system, the ideas which actually underpin the running of France as a country. And it has rippling effects throughout the world. However, the French Revolution soon starts to have to deal with some very serious issues. The main problem being that because they had overthrown the entire system of government and the whole way in which France worked as a country, it was a complete blank slate, and authority needed to be completely reconstructed. And actually, how will the people of France, a third estate that have managed to gain control, how will they actually cope with having that power, and how would they actually wield that power? So for 4 years between 1789 and 1793, the government was essentially just in a constant state of change and flux as all the different revolutionaries kept arguing about what was the best way to rule the country and what do these definitions of these kind of ideological principles that we've said are so important, what do they actually mean? Whilst at the same time, the government's in crisis because France was being attacked by foreign countries on all sides, and there was also the danger of a civil war breaking out in many of the different regions of France, some people, you know, arguing for the monarchy to come back. And so a man emerges called Maximilien Robespierre, who takes over the government, and he is a very radical revolutionary, and he starts what became known as the Reign of Terror. Now, Robespierre was an intelligent man. He'd read political philosophy at university, he'd studied hard to become a lawyer. You know, he was known for representing the poor in court, and he wrote various different essays and papers protesting against the rule of the upper classes before the French Revolution. He genuinely wanted to improve the lives of ordinary people in France who were being ignored by the previous system under the absolute monarchy. Now, when Robespierre makes himself head of the Committee of Public Safety, he believed it was his duty to ensure that the revolution was upheld and not to slip back into some kind of reformed monarchy like had happened in England after the English Civil War. And he believed that actually that duty to ensure the values of the revolution were upheld, his duty to do that, he even extended as far as violence. So one of his first actions was to execute Louis XVI and Marie Antoinette, who'd been caught trying to flee Paris in 1791, and they were imprisoned for 2 years, and actually he decides to execute them with the guillotine, which becomes very famous as a symbol of the French Revolution. So the Committee of Public Safety decides to introduce several new laws, and the key one being that they wanted to make terror an official government policy. The reason that Robespierre gives for this is the following. To good citizens, revolutionary government owes the full protection of the state. To the enemies of the people, it owes only death. So in his view, if you're a good citizen, then you're going to be fine. But if you are going to try and subvert the revolution and try and find some kind of way to go against the idea of equality and freedom and brotherhood, if you're going to try and not fulfill those things that the revolution was for, then actually you need to die. But this was known as the law of suspects, that said that anyone who was even suspected as being an enemy of the revolution was to be arrested. And they created courts called revolutionary tribunals for the trial of political enemies. But the only outcome that you could get from that trial was to let the person go or to execute them. There was no prison, it was just freedom or execution. And you can imagine that if you've been arrested for supposedly being a suspect of being against the revolution, then the result that often was given, if not always, was execution. So for a whole year, under this terror, under Maximilien Robespierre, people had to be careful of everything they said, everything they did, who they talked to, because the slightest hint of opposition could mean death. And, you know, sometimes revolutionaries would accuse people they didn't like or people they wanted to get rid of without any evidence, because all you had to do was accuse someone and they were considered guilty. So 17,000 people were officially executed in France during that year, including 2,639 people in Paris alone. And many more people died from beatings or, you know, kind of imprisoned, awaiting trial. And over 200,000 people were arrested for various different offences. As the bloodshed and executions of the terror became worse and worse, many people realised that it just couldn't continue like this. It was absolute chaos. It was violent and not a nice place to be living in. You know, the ideas of the revolution had somehow gone astray, even though Maximilien Robespierre was trying to achieve them. He was too obsessed with the vision of what the absolute ideal republic would be, and had a kind of complete indifference to the human cost of creating that ideal vision of what he thought society should look like. And so enemies of Robespierre decided to overthrow him, and on July 27th, 1794, he was executed. Now, during this period, news of the French Revolution received a kind of mixed response in Britain, because on the one hand, the ideas of freedom and equality seemed quite appealing to, you know, people in Britain who were just like the French, you know, disenfranchised, poor working conditions, poor pay, you know, a rising inequality between the different classes as a result of the Industrial Revolution. There were some really important books written, like Thomas Paine's Rights of Man and Mary Wollstonecraft's Vindication of the Rights of Women, that argued for a fairer society and encouraged petitions to be sent to the House of Commons. And so, you know, the events that had happened in France did provoke quite a lot of, you know, internal reflection in Britain about the way in which society was organised on class and gender lines. We can also see a kind of hint of ideas that Britain is somehow superior to France, because England had already kind of gone through a revolution of sorts and abandoned absolute monarchy in favour of constitutional monarchy. So some people saw the French Revolution as just, you know, kind of like the inevitable turn of history, that actually, you know, they're going through that period that Britain had already gone through, and that's why Britain's empire was bigger, etc. Actually, what we see political philosophers more concerned about is the idea that France has gone through a revolution which is guided by these principles that, as the example of Robespierre's terror has shown, the kind of terrible, chaotic, violent consequences that can result from an idealistic vision of society. And so there's kind of like a bit of a tension between whether society should change or whether it should maintain the status quo. Because the political elite have that dilemma, don't they? They, you know, either they you know, recognize that popular revolutionary violence is a threat, or they don't. And, you know, one way or the other, that kind of ghost that has been created by the, you know, role model of the French Revolution needed to be quelled somehow. There's a lot of debate in Parliament about understanding the need for the loyalty of the poor in order to remain in power and avoid a revolution, but still a kind of stubborn refusal to trust lower class people to actually exercise democratic rights responsibly. So the way in which they decide to kind of make a compromise to move forward is to create a lot of kind of propaganda about the glory of Britain, the glory of the empire, the importance of the monarchy, and kind of the glory of the monarchy and the history and the traditions of Britain, to contrast the violence and chaos and kind of lack of tradition and historical continuity that the French Revolution had brought. So, you know, this is a way to recognise the power of the people, but still decline them democratic rights, but by creating some kind of unity for them together to realise that actually Britain is stronger and better because of the way in which they are moving forward, and that we shouldn't change it because, you know, look at what's happened in France. And eventually that unity in Britain is firmly established with the rise of Napoleon Bonaparte from 1799 onwards, who takes over France and essentially becomes a new form of king, calling himself a first consul, having a coronation, and then going on to invade most of Europe, in which Britain fights Napoleon on the mainland in order to, you know, quell the French threat.